morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and Ann's having a horse.
Ann's a little croaky today. Croaky. I said, is it a small horse or a large horse that you have?
Yeah.
It's a little horse. Always a little joke. It's a little horse.
Yes. Well, here we are. Back again. And we have an exciting show as usual.
Of course we do.
This one being icons of the food business is how you term that.
Yeah, they're unusual icons. But they're people whose work, for whatever reason, and they're all different reasons, really stands out to us, as the food business is filled with wonderful people anyway, whether it's chefs and restaurateurs, they're people of a generous mind, people in the beverage business, obviously in the same way. Today we've assembled people that we met over the last few months who, for whatever reason, we think are doing something particularly interesting.
Did we say it's on the menu?
Oh, yeah. I don't know we ever did. No, you're actually listening on, you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, of course. And first up for today, a fascinating gentleman called Sean Eskenazi. Well, let's not spoil the interview. Let's just play the story and you can judge for yourself why we thought he was such an important icon in the business.
Well, you know, I think I've had this secret crush on Sean Eskenazi for a long time. How many years, Sean?
It's been about 5 years, I think.
At least, I think, yeah.
And listeners, they've never met. It's entirely platonic, and it's probably since Mrs. Eskenazi.
It's chocolatonic.
Well, since Mrs. Eskenazi might be listening in, we better make sure we realize that.
I guess it did sound a little weird. But anyhow, well, we interviewed Sean, I guess pretty close to when you were starting your chocolate company, Sean, right?
Right, that's right.
Eskenazi Chocolate. But that was a while ago. I'd like to do three things. One, I'd like for you to recap your very interesting background. You know, you used to be a high-power defense attorney, right?
Right, that's right. And I'm not sure if I was high-powered, but I was a defense attorney.
Into murders and things like that. Well, I want you to sort of briefly recap that, and then we want to talk about what purpose is with Eskenazi Chocolate, your company's mission. You do a lot of other things, a lot of community involvement things, and we'll talk about that too. Why don't you start with where you came from and how you ended up in the Amazon with chocolates?
Yes. Well, thank you. First of all, thank you for having me. I really, really appreciate it, and this is a great opportunity, and I love to make chocolate, but I also love to tell the story. And for me, I was a criminal defense lawyer for about 20 years and really worked very hard at it, and I loved it, and there came a time that I just needed to do something else, and so I just didn't know what it was going to be, and
you
I spent about five
with,
years.
You started out with looking around for cupcakes.
Yes, exactly. Well, and I did, and I made thousands of cupcakes, and my friends and family have enjoyed that over the years, and they enjoyed it a lot more when I first started, but that's what I thought that I would do, and then I went to chocolate desserts, and then I actually started, the idea came to me to make chocolate from scratch. I just didn't know what that meant. I didn't know it came from a bean. But within a few months of that, I was in the Amazon working with farmers there trying to figure out how we could influence the flavor of chocolate by what they did with cocoa bean. And that's where it all started. And then I started buying equipment and I bought a building and just went from there. And then I quit my law practice.
I think some people listening to this might think you're a little bit of a crackpot.
Well, that's the thing. When I was a lawyer, there were people who, when you defend people who are accused of serious crime, you're not out to make friends. You're out to work hard defending the person accused. And so I've kind of developed a thick skin over the years, and I think it's served me well also in chocolate because it's allowed me to really just laser focus on what I think our mission should be and what our service to the community should be, regardless of what people are saying, because I've learned to kind of tune that out over the years because I had to.
I think we ought to inject a comment here because I've tasted your chocolate and you don't just have all the mission sounds and whistles and so forth. You make fantastic chocolate.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And learned a whole lot. How many years has it been then?
It's been 5 years of selling, but it was a year of acquiring equipment and building our building. And so it's been 7 years for me, but 5 years of this business and selling these chocolate bars.
How to describe your chocolate? I mean, certain clarity about your chocolate. You could tell where it comes from if you know what you're talking about.
The one way to describe it is I think there's a purity in the taste of the chocolate because we put so few ingredients in our core product line. And that is just cocoa beans and organic sugar, and that's it. And so I think that there's a lot of flavor notes that are distinct in those chocolate bars. And I think for other chocolate makers who use few ingredients that you'll find similar qualities.
You make varieties of chocolate, tend to like bars a lot, right?
Right. That's what we do. We really focus on chocolate bars and not confections because that's not our specialty. We don't know how to do that. And so we focus on bars and also on cocoa powder. We sell a lot of cocoa powder. And then we also have a chocolate hazelnut spread, and we've gotten pretty good at that. And we source our hazelnut from a farm in Linden, Washington, and make our own hazelnut butter here. So we've gotten pretty good at those. And that's kind of what our focus is.
Now, you keep winning these finalist Silver Sophies. What do you think? Why have you not gotten the gold? Because I think it's gold quality.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. And the truth is, these competitions are quite an honor, really, just to be selected to. And I know people say, well, it's an honor to be. Well, really, it really is. I mean, the people who are with us in this chocolate category are people that I respect, admire their work. So the fact that we have not won gold, really, I don't know. It just could be that maybe that year the judges were looking for a particular flavor profile or combination, and that maybe we just didn't have it. But I think that I've kind of learned this over the years. I would rather build up a big pile of those silvers than just one gold for one product, because I think that you begin to develop name and a reputation over the years of a steady, just day in and day out making a great product, whatever it may be. And when you're recognized for that, it's great, and that's nice. It's certainly helpful. But the one big thing, or winning gold, is not really what makes a career. And it's certainly not what makes a company.
Well, now you do so many ancillary activities, and you don't stay still. Just refocused in a way on your farmers by redesigning all your packaging.
Right. And since we last talked, you know, we've introduced more products. We have 4 origins now. And some of our customers were saying that they were not able to tell the difference between the bars and the products. And so we were faced with a challenge of what to do to kind of distinguish our bars. There's not, or at least in the previous packaging, there wasn't a whole lot of color or anything that made one bar stand out from the other except the name of the bar. And so we decided to introduce 2 things. 1, color to differentiate the bars, and secondly, to make the picture of the farmer bigger. And the farmers, all of them, love their picture on the bar.
Oh, do they really?
Yeah, oh yeah. It's funny because they all get joked and ribbed and kidded by their fellow farmers, but it's all in fun, and they really, really, I mean, it really is an honor to them to be on this bar, and it's something that they're really proud of. And now that I go back every year to these farms, I know that over time it's something that is a source of pride for them. The bigger picture is even better.
Now, how many origins? Tell us what these origins are.
Well, we currently source from 4 different origins: the Philippines, Honduras, Ecuador, and Tanzania. And as I was thinking about this the other day, I'm not aware of another chocolate company that direct trades with farmers on so many continents.
Yeah, you really move around.
Yeah, I have friends who may source from Central America or South America, but not in Asia and Africa as well. And so that is quite a challenge for us. And, you know, when you think about it, even the industrial chocolate makers, you know, Hershey's of the world, they are not direct trading with farmers. They're not out there negotiating directly with farmers to buy their beans. They're negotiating with large brokers and buyers, and that's how they have to accumulate their products. So, you know, I'm not aware of a company in Europe that's doing it, direct trading that is, with so many countries. And so I love it, though. I enjoy the travel. It's a chance for me to kind of untether from the computer and telephone and all that stuff. And I don't mind the weather. It's usually very hot and humid where I go. And so I enjoy it. And one of those origins, I just got back from Tanzania a few days ago and brought 13 high school students and 3 university students, a couple of teachers and people from our community. Chocolate University is a part of our company. We started it when we first started the company, and that was to engage young people in our neighborhood in our business. Just quite simply, teaching them about social entrepreneurship and about a world beyond Springfield, Missouri. And we do it with elementary kids, middle school kids, but with the high school students, we have a special program where we have a really intense application process, and we pick 12 or 13 of them and some university students. And half of them are private pay, the other half are scholarship students, and we raise all the money for them to go.
How do you do that?
Well, part of it is every tour we give of the factory, and it seems like we're doing one a day, sometimes two a day, we charge people for those, and all of that money, 100% of it, goes into an account at our local community foundation, and so we use that money, and then there are others around the country who believe in the mission that we have, which is exposing young people, and specifically high school juniors, to short-term trips with us to Tanzania because it has the potential to really change their lives, change the course of their college careers, and ultimately their careers. And so we get donors from around the country who make donations to our community foundation fund, tax deductible, and that's how we do it. And this last time, and this is the second time I've done this with students, but this last time we brought them to meet Mama Kiesha, whose picture that you see on the front of that chocolate bar there. She's a single mom with 6 kids, a choir leader in her church, and a cocoa farmer, and the leader of this very small farmer business group. This is remote, remote Tanzania. It's the furthest that you can go from the capital. And it takes us over 30 hours to get there. And I had a group of about 20 people with me, and we had to take 2 single-engine charter planes and then a bus. And anyway, it's quite an adventure. But once we got there, they met Mama Kiesha and the other farmers, and then we had a special project at the school next to the village where we buy these beans, and that was 3 things. Number one, we brought 6 laptop computers with us, and we raised the money for those, and we downloaded 3,000 school class lessons on each laptop, 3,000, and in something called the Khan Academy, which so all this online classwork was free, and now this school, this high school, can have access to these videos of math, science, economics, business, history, and now, mind you, this is in a school with a 100-to-1 student-teacher ratio, so
oh,
there's
geez.
10 teachers, that's it, 10 teachers,
oh, wow.
And so this is going to change their school, because before this, they didn't have any books in a whole high school, and then we, the year before last, we raised money for them to build a library, and we donated $10,000 worth of books for them to have. But anyway, this computer thing, we wired their classrooms, and this is a school with no electricity, so we bought a generator, we brought all the wire with us, we brought projectors with us, and now the kids in the classroom can watch the class lesson on a screen, and so that was a big project for us and our students. The second one, and this is one that I'm really excited about, is this, if you can imagine, every kid in this school eats one meal a day. That's it, just one, all of them. And so you can't study on an empty stomach. And so with the headmaster, and I've been working on this for about a year, I asked the PTA of this school to make a product that I could import on my container of cocoa beans, and then I could resell and leverage that money to help them. And they make this beautiful rice there. It's Kiela. It's called Kiela, the town rice. It's a premium rice. It's naturally sweet. And so anyway, I bought a metric ton of rice, and while I was there, our kids and their kids stamped the front and back of these little cloth rice bags, 1 kilo each, and then they filled the rice together, and that'll go on my container in the fall. And I bought it for $1.50 a bag, and I'm going to sell it for $15.50 a bag, and all of the profits, all of them, will feed all 1,000 kids lunch every day for a year.
Oh, yeah,
so in the PT, yeah, and so what it is, what's beautiful about this is nobody is donating anything. There's no government grant for anything. It's their PTA working for their own children, and me just being the conduit to leverage this money and giving them access to a market that they wouldn't otherwise have. The PTA of this school will manage this. They'll put funds in an account every month to help them buy the food for their school, and so it's going to work really nicely. And then, of course, the third project was we had to measure the height, weight, and arm circumference of the students in the school to give them a kind of a baseline. So that's Chocolate University at the high school level, and it's been a very successful program. And our kids that have been involved have really had their lives changed. And this is a part of our company that is, well, it's a core of who we are as a company, because we recognize that if you don't make great tasting chocolate, if we don't make great tasting chocolate, then we can't do these other things. So it's at the forefront of our mind to have the highest possible quality beans and chocolate that we can make. And then it allows us to fulfill our mission, which is to serve. To serve our farmers, our neighborhood, our community, and that's what we want to do. That's why we're here.
Sean Askenosi, you are a marvel. You are absolutely incredible.
Not really. No.
Well, you are when I see all you're doing. And we haven't even talked about half of your ancillary activities yet, but although we'll probably have to talk more frequently than every 5 years.
Yeah, no kidding.
Is there a website that people can go to that will tune them into, you know, those people who are inspired by what we just talked about? Is there somewhere they can get like an Askenosi project update?
Sure. There's two, and they're connected to each other, but just askenosi.com. Our main website has an entire feature on Chocolate University in it. So askinosie.com or chocolateuniversity.org. ChocolateUniversity.org is our website, which is specific to the projects I mentioned, and there's some just wonderful blog posts by our students that are available to read there of the kind of experiences that they've had and how it's changed their lives. And I really believe that. I think if just 10 days, if we can expose young people to what's happening in the world, it really can make a difference. And so that's a very important project to us.
I think we have another project coming up pretty soon called Askenosi for President.
No. No, that's, don't even get me started there. I'm doing what I need to do, and it's a lot of fun. I make a whole lot less money than I did as a lawyer, but I knew that going in. When I made this choice, I knew that my lifestyle would change, and it's been a kind of a bumpy ride, but I'm really glad that I've had the chance to do this. I'm so thankful.
And you can get chocolate online?
You can buy chocolate online at the askenosi.com website, and all of the chocolate products that we were talking about are available there and in small specialty food stores around the country.
And do you have a store finder in the set?
We don't have one, and that's kind of a problem. And if people just email us at info@askenosi.com, and say, tell us where they live, we get right back to people and we'll say, okay, here's the stores in your neighborhood, or there isn't one, and here's how you can order online.
Well, listen, you better go back to work.
That's right. Yeah, we're having equipment issues this week, and wouldn't you know it, I get back from Tanzania, and it seems like when it rains, it pours. We're having some issues with, you know what, and we're in the middle of the country. It's very hot and very humid. That's the worst time to make chocolate, so we're dealing with some humidity issues in our equipment, how to solve those problems. So, yeah, we're busy at that today.
Okay, well,
sure.
you better go back and fix that. A pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
I hope we'll talk to you again sooner than 5 years from now.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Sean. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So now you know the story of why we think Sean is such a very special kind of guy. And we'll be right back with you after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next, we're going to be talking to Popcorn Royalty. I bet you didn't even know there was such a thing.
And we didn't either. But
this is Claire Creeders, and she will explain how this
it's a whole set of family businesses, not just one.
Right.
To call them popcorn kings and queens, I think would be to underestimate the influence that they have over this product that you all love so much. So. Here are the Creeders and the cornfields explaining their story, and it's a fascinating one.
Well, I have to admit that I have been for my whole life in love with popcorn. That's not a grammatically correct sentence, but you've got the gist of what I'm saying. I am a popcorn lover. So here we have Claire Creeders, who is, well, I guess we'd call it royalty of popcorn.
From both sides, no less. Welcome to On the Menu, Claire.
Thank you so much.
You are the president, and your mother is the CEO of which company now?
Cornfields Incorporated.
Okay. And the popcorn-making company is G.H. Kreeder's?
Right. So Cornfields Incorporated, actually, we produce and we own the G.H. Kreeder's popcorn brand, yes.
Okay, well, jump back in time to us, because what I loved was that your great-great or great-great-great-grandfather invented the commercial popcorn-making machine.
He did. So he was my three greats. Great-great-great-grandpa Kreeder's in 1885 had the first patent on the popcorn machine. And the story is that he was actually a candy store owner, and he wanted to sell some roasted peanuts out of his store. So he bought a peanut roaster, and it didn't work very well. He was a bit of an engineer, so he kind of refabricated this peanut roaster and, of course, made it better, but also discovered a way of popping corn in its own oil and salt, using the same sort of type of technology. That sort of launched the category, and that was all the way back in 1885. He brought his machine to the Columbian Exposition in Chicago in 1893.
That must have been some exposition, by the way. Everything.
It was. There was, I think, Gummis was there showing his Ferris wheel. Wrigley was there with new gum invention, so it was quite monumental.
Now, had people been popping corn before using a manual process, or did he essentially almost invent popcorn itself?
No, I mean, certainly the Native Americans were popping corn long before we were, over an open fire, but he was able to commercialize it. So using, you know, different type of technology, as you know, when you pop corn, even over your stove, you get sort of an uneven popping. Some of it burns, which I personally love, actually. So he was able to produce a very consistent product that he could then sell to customers directly.
And it turns out that his machine was so good that it dominates the business to this day, right? I'm surprised nobody bought an antitrust suit against you, because I think your material says you 95% of the machines that make popcorn in the United States are made by your company.
This is true, yes. So next time you're in the movie theater, you can look at the machine, and most likely it will say Kreeder's on it.
Do you know about this product that, you know, if you like the burnt corn, I don't know if you like that. We used to call them old maids, the unpopped ones. There's a company called Half Pops.
I have heard of those. They're sort of half-popped kernels, right?
Yeah, well, it's not quite that simple, but they are fabulous.
Yes.
You should check those out. Yeah.
I've seen them. They're almost like corn nuts, right?
They are sort of like corn nuts.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just stopping the popping. There's something else.
Okay.
But anyhow, so this gets even more exciting. So your grandfather, your great-great-great-grandfather invented this machine, but then how did you get from that to...
So from it's a bit complicated, so I'll try and make it as simple as possible.
I thought you could make it into a musical, actually.
That would be fun. So many, many years later, my father got into the business, of course, and C. Kreeder's and Company is now in fifth generation, so it's quite unique in that respect. But he got involved in the business, and separately, my mother was inheriting a company from her father, who had just passed away, that made some popcorn components. So sort of lost and needed some guidance, and knew of this guy called George Henry Kreeder's, and so she called him up and needed some advice, and it was a popcorn love story, and they were shortly thereafter married, and my mom's business turned into a company called the Popcorn Factory, which is still in business now. It's owned by 1-800-Flowers, and my father left Kreeder's and started this company, which is Cornfields. So as opposed to making machines like the rest of his family, he wanted to make finished product.
And he does.
And so that's what we continue to do today with our G.H. Kreeder's brand is make the finished product here.
And these are all natural, all very admirable in terms of the quality of the corn. And how many flavors?
So we have five flavors. We have our what we call our hero, which is our Chicago mix. It's a cheese and caramel mixed together in the same bag. What really makes our caramel different, and I know, Ann, you were saying your girlfriend loved the caramel corn. We make all of our caramel in copper kettles. So we really are trying to maintain the old-fashioned process, not just for the story, but it really does affect the flavor. You get a really wonderful flavor when you cook in copper.
See, that sort of struck me as funny because of your connection with the popcorn machines, that you should revert to the old-fashioned.
Right, of course. It is funny. I mean, we certainly pop the corn in Kreeder's machines, but as far as the caramel goes, yes, we have gone back to 1885, I suppose you can say, and continue to make the caramel mixture in the copper kettles. And we're doing also lots of different things, but, corn syrup, which is used in most caramel corns these days. We've chosen to use brown rice syrup, which is a really wonderful flavor.
And what about the cheese? I mean, what kind of cheese? Is it real cheese?
It's real cheese. I mean, it's a cheese powder, but it's derived from certainly just sort of a broken down real cheddar cheese. We went through lots of research and development on deciding the right cheese because it really does affect that combination. We went through very fancy cheeses. Do we put hints of garlic or things like that, and realize that at the end of the day, just a really delicious old-fashioned cheddar cheese is what most people will come back for. So I think it served us well, and we've just kept it at just the best cheddar cheese we can find.
Your involvement with this, you probably just never thought of doing anything else, huh?
Yeah, I tried.
What did you do?
I don't think I had much of a choice, but no, I grew up with it. Certainly at the popcorn factory, I spent my afternoons after school in the sample room, surrounded by popcorn and treats and things like that. But it was an honor. You know, it was a pretty wonderful thing to be able to do with your family, and of course to have success at it is pretty exciting.
And you have some ideas as to why all of a sudden there's this rise of interest, big scale rise of interest, you know, as demonstrated at the Fancy Food Show, in gourmet popcorn.
Right. It's a wonderful phenomenon. Popcorn historically, and my mother would tell you, has always been very cyclical. So it's just one of those categories that kind of goes up and down. But it's certainly been quite dramatic in terms of what it's done recently. There's been a lot of media around the health benefits of popcorn and the antioxidant value in corn itself. People are going back to less processed products, and popcorn, as you know, is just a natural whole grain. We just simply pop it. And of course, yes, we put sweetness on it or salty, but at the end of the day, the base of that product is very unprocessed. So that's all part of it.
Where do you grow your corn?
All of our corn comes from the Midwest, so most of it comes out of Nebraska. We are using all non-genetically modified ingredients, so we've really committed ourselves to that.
Yeah, that's
so beyond
important.
All natural, we're doing non-GMO, and everything is, we try and keep everything local so we can reduce our environmental footprint as much as we can.
So, and has the drought affected your company, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I mean, we won't see the effect probably until the harvest, which will be October, November. And popping corn, a lot of our corn, fortunately, is grown in irrigated fields, so the drought has minimized that. We'll certainly see price increases, I think, but that's inevitable. We'll be able to keep that internally, and that hopefully the consumers won't see it on the market, but hopefully we'll have enough supply as well, so.
This brings us, of course, to the ultimate question. Now we have everyone drooling about this popcorn. Where does one get?
Well, you could go on our website to find the store closest to you. So the website is ghcreeders.com.
R-E-T-O-R-S.
Correct. Amazon.com carries all of our flavors, so you can buy in bulk, which is wonderful. You can buy it off of our website directly. And if you go on our Facebook page and like our Facebook page, we're often doing promotions and giveaways and things like that for the popcorn. But we have pretty good distribution here in the Midwest. We're in Foods. Just picked us up, and that's been exciting.
Oh,
Fresh Market.
Good.
Yep, Fresh Market. Whole Foods is always a good indicator of quality, so
right.
We're certainly pleased with that.
Now, you are married to a Frenchman. You're about to take off to visit his family in the south of France. Do they eat popcorn in France?
Well, it's funny that you bring him up because JB is also our vice president of sales.
Uh-huh.
So our family business goes into marriage as well. We also met through the snack business. And ironically, he's been in the snack business now for about 12 years, and the answer is no. The French do not eat a lot of popcorn. So not only do they not eat a lot of popcorn, they just, snacking is just not something they do, so we should probably all learn from them. But he has adjusted well to marrying into a snack family.
You know, you're right. I was just thinking, what do they eat instead of popcorn? But they just don't snack.
No, it's not. So we always bring popcorn down there, and they love it. But it's unusual. They're not sure when to eat it. Is it dessert? is it breakfast? And they always say, you know, corn is for pigs. I'm working on them. I'm working on the French, and soon, one day, it will happen.
Well, you're a delight to talk to, and your product is delightful, and I love your history. And don't forget this musical we're going to have to write.
Okay. who will play? I'm not sure who will play me, or who will play Phyllis. We'll see. Thank you very much. It was very nice to meet you, too.
Thanks, Claire. Talk to you again.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and
how are you doing with your little horse? It seems to be better.
It's a little better.
Okay, good.
But basically, everybody wants to know the backstory on somebody who really influenced how we view food and changed the whole direction of food.
So this is a second-hand version.
Well, the author is Tom McNamee, and he really researched this very thoroughly, and it's titled "The Man Who Changed
the Way America Eats." Yeah. Amazing story, Craig Claiborne. Wherever you are watching us. We hope you enjoy this tribute, and those of you who are interested in the history of how it all came about, this is going to be a must-read book.
Does everyone know who is the man who changed the way we eat? Well, it's Craig Claiborne, and he is
no, that
credited.
I was thinking it was Ray Kroc or Dave Thomas.
You would have. If you read this book by Thomas McNamee, I think the direction, you have to admit that he's right, and that this was sort of like the springboard for all that happened following his reign as one of the first restaurant critics, I guess, of the New York Times. And welcome to On the Menu, Thomas.
Thank you.
Did you enjoy writing this book?
Well, as much as I've ever enjoyed writing a book, writing is work.
It took me to some great places,
and I ate some great meals. That's the part I liked about it. The writing itself is simply labor.
See, I've written my whole entire life, but I'm bulking it more and more now, I think. What attracted you to the project to start with?
Well, I first learned to cook from the New York Times cookbook and also Julia Child, Volume 1. And I didn't really associate it with the author at the time. I probably didn't even think about it. But in my early years out of college, living in New York, my wife and I taught ourselves to cook and cook well. And I had a rich uncle from Mississippi who would come up to New York and rent a limousine and take us around to La Grenade and Lutèce and the Côte Basque and so on. And so I got an early opportunity to taste a lot of this kind of really great food. And then, in part encouraged by Craig Claiborne, we started going to France and eating in the great 2- and 3-star restaurants of France. And so I early on had a great interest in really good food, although that's not what I ended up writing about in most of my life. And when this opportunity arose, and I went to a 2-day sort of powwow in New York, one day sponsored by the New School and the other one sponsored by the Center for the Study of Southern Culture at the University of Mississippi. Everybody who had ever known Craig, who was still alive, came to this thing and talked, people from the Times, people from Mississippi, friends of his, and so on. And I realized that there was a tremendous amount of psychological territory to be explored, as well as the interesting culinary history.
Yeah, and you, of course, share the Southern heritage.
I do. My father was from the Mississippi Delta, very much from Craig's own social class and from the same world. And the Delta is a very unusual place. It's a very isolated culture to this day, and much more so when Craig Claiborne was growing up. And it's not a place that's easily understood. It's easily caricatured, you know, mm-hmm. racist, stupid, poor, hot. those things are all true, but there's more to it than that. And so I felt I had a leg up in having spent a lot of time in the Mississippi Delta when I was growing up.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's so certain parts of this that today, going around for your day-to-day tasks, you don't think about, but reading this book, you look back and you think of what a hideous, hideous experience it would be coming from that environment, on top of all that being gay.
Well, that's what certainly made his life difficult, because from early childhood, Craig was a sissy and beat up on by the other little boys, and his parents had no sympathy for that whatever, so he had no place of refuge. He didn't really have any friends until he got well into his teens, and the one place he could go for comfort and sort of shelter was the kitchen of his mother's boarding house, which had several cooks and other people who worked in there. And so they sort of took him in, and he'd sit on the lap of a cook and help her ice a cake or something like that when he was a little kid. And so he was early on exposed to these wonderful smells and tastes of old-fashioned Southern cooking, deeply imprinted with those things, and naturally he associated those with comfort as well, because it's the only place he found any comfort as a child.
Well, his relationship with his mother is pretty tragic, too. I mean, that was really awful, huh?
It was bad. It's mysterious. I never have quite figured out why he hated his mother so much. His main complaint against her was that she loved him too much and was too demonstrative about it.
Yeah, but then he had all that goings-on with his father. And the father...
Well, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I think there's a good argument to be made that that thing that he talks about in
his
own memoir, A Feast Made for Laughter, may never have happened. Craig loved to shock people.
Mm-hmm.
And he told a lot of... He told stories in both senses, in the little kid's sense as well. And I think maybe something happened, maybe it didn't. But if you read the very words, and I've read them many times in that passage in that book, the more you read them, the less sense they make.
Uh-huh.
You can't tell whether it happened once or 50 times or did it happen at all. If I had to stake my life on it, I would guess that he really didn't have any kind of sexual relationship with his father.
Now, how long did it take you to research this book? And what were the... I mean, he was so haphazard. David, on one hand, saving every little scrap of receipt and everything. And on the other, as you say, telling these stories. How did you go about researching it, and how long did it take you?
Well, yes, it took about 2 years. Besides the fact that there were several people who really remembered Craig and stories about him extremely well. One was an artist named Ed Joby, who was a very close friend of his. And the other is Diane Frenet, who's the daughter of Craig's longtime writing partner,
right,
Pierre Frenet. And even though Diane was only a teenager during some of the time that she was remembering, she has just a remarkable memory. But most of all, there's a wonderful man, now no longer with us, named Howard Gottlieb, who was a librarian at Boston University. Started an archive of people's personal papers, everybody from Betty Davis to Martin Luther King. And different from other archives, which tended to focus only on the more important things from a person's life, so that you go through a box of a typical archive and you see all these plaques, framed pictures of people getting awards, and official letters from somebody commending them. Gottlieb said, I want everything. Just give me your junk.
Sort of Andy Warhol-like, huh?
But the point is that, I mean, and it was, you know, I don't know, 24 giant boxes or more at the BU library. I spent weeks there. And I was able to piece together much about Craig's life from these little scraps. Because,
yeah,
for example, for the last 15 years of his life, he had a love affair with a married man from Florida, a Republican.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out why. I mean, because you imply that he was pretty irresistible, or he thought he was, actually, Craig thought. And, you know, I look at him and I think, I don't understand it. You know, that man had a lot at stake, didn't he?
He did, yeah. I mean, he's dead now. I never got any testimony from his side in any way. So I don't know what the story was for this guy, Jim Dineen. But Craig loved, I do know that Craig loved him desperately. And Jim did not love Craig quite so much because he had this other life. 4 children, head of the country club on all these hospital boards and things. He was very rich. And he had a lot more going on than just Craig. But in any case, when they would see each other, they would do so in secret, necessarily in the case of Dineen. But Craig also liked keeping that relationship secret because his friends really disapproved of that relationship. They said, Craig, this man is never going to leave his wife. you're just, you're hopelessly in love with somebody who's just not going to love you back. And he didn't care. He just loved him anyway.
Well, he was pretty stubborn, which I guess I don't want to give away the decline and demise, but he just sort of went his own way about everything, including doctor's instructions. Did you end up with this book thinking you still had a lot of mysteries to unravel?
Well, I think that's true of anybody. I'm still trying to unravel myself.
Yeah.
I think if you set out to understand a person fully in a biography, it's a chump's game. You'll never be able to do it. Many things I'd love to know more about. I would love to understand Jim Dineen. He has a son alive who's a lawyer who was one of the people who cleaned out Craig's house. When Craig died, he left almost everything he owned, including his house on Long Island and his apartment in New York City, to this guy, Dineen.
Yeah, and you said the wife did that.
The wife and the son came to collect and to clean out the house and everything. And the son's still around, but he wouldn't talk to me.
He wouldn't, huh?
Nope.
Well, interesting.
Wouldn't even return a phone call.
Oh, my. That must be frustrating for you. And the other question was, did you end up liking him any better, or liking him, period?
I tend to avoid that question when I'm writing about anybody. I think that making a decision about whether you like or dislike somebody is going to prejudice what you're doing. My modus operandi is to extend the maximum possible empathy. That's what I think a good biographer must do, extend empathy. And so to try to see Craig's life through Craig's eyes, if possible, get a sense of what it was like to be him. And how did he feel about himself? Well, sometimes he liked himself, sometimes he loved himself, sometimes he really hated himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so the best I can do as a biographer is to give the full richness of the emotional range of his own experience.
Well, I mean, I think that there's so many highlights in the food revolution in this book. From whatever point of view you come,
there are an awful lot of younger people who don't know who he was.
Oh, yeah, I know.
He didn't, you know, sort of promote himself as a star the way James Beard did. And Julia Child was just, of course, naturally a star. She's so great on television.
Yeah. I just interviewed somebody who wrote a book about Julia's cat.
Oh, sorry. You know you're famous if people are writing books about your cat.
Your cat, yes.
I think a lot of younger people don't understand how bleak and empty a landscape the American food world was before Craig appeared on the scene. World War II, women were going to work in very large numbers, and so they were not spending long hours in the kitchen anymore. This was the time, of course, of the emergence of industrial food, TV dinners, all these quickie things, frozen things, canned things. And so that was the world that Craig began his work in. And Americans not only didn't know, you know, Vietnamese or Brazilian cooking, they didn't know French cooking or Italian or Chinese.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the book in a different way.
Sure.
Because the title is about the man who changed the way America eats, not the flawed personality of the man who changed the way America eats.
Right.
And that's really a lot of what we've been talking about already. So,
yeah, true.
So here's the viewpoint I'd like you to comment on. If Craig Claiborne hadn't thought of the things that he did, if he hadn't explored the directions that he explored, would we be where we are today? I mean, was he a singular person? Did he make a singular contribution, or would other people have taken up the slack?
Well, that calls for speculation that I'm not capable of, but he made an immense difference.
It'd be so much more fun if you speculated.
Well, sorry. I think that, I mean, you have to consider that when he began his work, he was alone in this food world. There was no such thing as a restaurant critic. When he became the food editor of the New York Times, it meant being a columnist on the women's page. The food editor had never been a man before. The idea that you would actually criticize restaurants or food in general with the same level of intellectual authority and seriousness that book critics and art critics brought to their subjects, that was unheard of. And so when he began, he had immense scope, and he covered a tremendous amount of stuff. You know, food, yes, but food's place in the culture, what food could mean in a person's life, what entertaining and having dinner with your friends would be like if you only did it a certain way. When he began, people smoked at the table, but they rarely talked about food. It was considered, in some circles, impolite to talk about food. And of course, and it's fine to smoke, even during the meal. But when he began to introduce foreign foods, French food, authentic Italian food, authentic Chinese food, this was all completely new to Americans. Would somebody else have come along and done the same thing later? Who knows?
But he did it. He definitely did it first.
He did it first, and he did it alone.
But he did then create a pathway, if you like, that other people followed.
Yes.
So people like Gail Green and all the rest of the cast of characters who followed relatively soon after him in this new profession of professional criticism of food, they were essentially following in his footsteps.
Yes. To think of it as that it was for a long time, Craig was alone on top of an empire. He was the emperor, and he had no rivals. And eventually the empire broke up into principalities, and the food world became larger and larger and more multiplicitous. And each of these regions within it, not geographical regions, but regions of concern, began to develop their own experts. And, of course, when he set standards for restaurant criticism, and people loved to read his reviews in the Times, well, pretty soon most American newspapers decided they had to have restaurant critics as well, and then magazines.
Yeah, now I guess they're all deciding that they don't need them, which is a good full circle, right? Everybody's getting all the restaurant
critics.
Well,
if you want to count on Yelp or Zagat, I suppose that's what's going on, but there's not much expertise there.
No, I understand. We've got a slew of them.
But it might be fair to say that we will not see his like again, you think, right? Because the environment isn't really possible to be that different and unique anymore.
That's right. I mean, he entered into he planted his flag on an unsettled land, claimed a territory that nobody else had claimed, and now it's all claimed by, you know, hundreds of contenders.
Thomas McNamee, I wish you luck on this book, The Man Who Changed the Way We Eat. You also, you directed me towards an earlier book you wrote, which I should read, Alice Waters in Japanese, because I have some reservations about her, too. So it'll be interesting to read that.
You're a bit late.
I'm having a good time today.
Now, Tom, before you say goodbye, you are working on a, shall we call it a follow-on project right now?
Still at the proposal stage. I'm going to do a Craig Claiborne's Greatest Hits cookbook, taking really my choice, pretty subjective, what I consider, you know, 100 or 125 of his best things or most fun things or most unusual things, and in some cases be doing them exactly as he did them, and other times I'll be consulting with chefs to talk about possibly doing them with some more modern techniques. We have many more techniques and tools and ingredients at our beck and call than Craig ever did.
Well, will you make us a promise? Will you come back and talk to us again when this book is on the street?
I'll be honored. Thank you.
Great. Well, have fun with your ongoing project then.
Thanks very much.
And we'll keep in touch.
Great, thanks.
Thanks, Thomas. Bye.
And we'll be back with the final segment of today's program right after this break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, we're back with our final segment, and a little bit of a do-over in the middle here, but Queen City, for those of you who don't know, in the United States, these United States, is Cincinnati.
I don't know why it's called.
I'm not sure why, but I know it is, and the Queen City Cookie is named after that city, and Peggy Shannon. Abandoned a professional career and decided to bake cookies because that would enable her to give back to the community, and she's done a truly remarkable job in the just a few years this business has been running. And you'll find out about Schnecken,
yeah,
and a wide variety of other things. But aside from the wonderful product, a wonderful lady making a wonderful contribution to society, and that's the theme of today's program. So here's Peggy.
We're talking to the queen of Queen City Cookies, Peggy Shannon. Welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you so much for having us. We love the program. It's such a delight to be here.
Oh, well, you've been very busy, and it's amazing you have time to do anything besides bake.
It is, really.
What's going on in Cincinnati? I mean, everything's been coming out of Cincinnati all of a sudden. I never thought of it as that much of a, artisanal city.
It's always been a food town.
It's really an extraordinary city, and I think one, not being a Cincinnati native, I was recruited out of grad school and moved here in 2006, and of course I call the Queen City my home now, but I think it's a city that is very much coming into its own. but one that is greatly underestimated by people outside of the city. But it's an extraordinary food town, and we had for years, actually, with the Maisonette, and there were several other restaurants, we had, I think, 3 or 4 5-star restaurants for quite a while. And with John Robert at the helm, still we have several amazing eateries. But there's just been a real resurgence of food, the slow movement food and locavore. And there's also one of the things that your listeners would really enjoy. There's a food online magazine called 513 Eats. EATS, that the writing and the photography is as good as anything you'll see anywhere.
Well, now that explains Cincinnati, but it doesn't explain how you got recruited to Cincinnati in 2006 and now you make cookies.
Yeah, it was really very a long and fortuitous path. It was very exciting. I was in graduate school at Indiana University for arts administration.
I was the curator of education in Indianapolis for years.
Oh, fun. Well, I grew up in Lafayette, which is just about...
Oh, I know where it is, yeah.
Yeah, close. So I was recruited to move to Cincinnati to be the marketing director at the Contemporary Arts Center and started baking, and in 2009, the Christmas issue of Martha Stewart Living caught my attention with all of these beautiful antique Springerly molds and cookies on the cover, and it really started me on the path that I am now. I fell in love with the molds and started baking them, and people continued to suggest that I start a bakery and go into business, and I really wasn't interested in that. And as the economy started to tank, I became increasingly frustrated at the budget cuts in
the
city.
Arts, yeah. How did you hit on the elephants theme? You're fond of pachyderms because your cookies are all shaped like elephants.
Well, it's interesting, actually, and each of our 9 different products that we produce, each of them has their own signature elephant, each of which has their own personality
and
history.
Tell me about that.
Well,
it's like somebody who's stuck in fantasy land when you're talking about the personalities of these different elephants.
Yeah, well, I think probably a lot of people think I'm stuck in fantasy land, and it's fun to be surrounded by all of those characters. I've written a lot of short stories about each one of them, but the elephants, in general, as you well know, are symbols of abundance and loyalty and so many blessings and wisdom. And I am, of course, those attributes certainly signify everything that Queen City Cookies is about. But the real truth of the matter is that from the time I was little and growing up, every single place that I ever lived moving forward from being a child, I always assessed on its ability to house an elephant. And either I wouldn't have the money or I wouldn't have the land available for an elephant. And so even when I was at graduate school at IU, I was on 6 acres. I lived out in the country, and I thought, wow, I could have an elephant on 6 acres, which, of course, is ludicrous.
You're serious about wanting to have an elephant?
I'm very serious. And I still actually, being a foodie, I don't know if you've made it to Blackberry Farm.
We've interviewed them about their cookbook,
well,
but we've never been there,
What's very exciting about it for elephant lovers is the gentleman, and I forget his name, but the gentleman who's in charge of the truffle dog program that they have there with those adorable dogs that are imported from Italy, he was an elephant trainer for almost all of his professional life and has just recently started training these dogs. So for me to go to Blackberry Farm, you're surrounded by this amazing food and environment, but then hook up with this guy if you're interested in elephants, because he's got quite a few tails. So I still have yet to completely throw in the elephant blanket, I guess, as it were, and say that that will never happen, but it occurred to me that opening your own business and growing and developing the different products lines is such an endeavor, and I knew that the work and commitment it would take, so I wanted to surround myself with beans that give me a lot of joy, and that was just the elephant. So we've had a lot of fun with them.
You have, just tell us briefly, like, some of the names.
And interestingly, they're all named after people very, very important in my life. My first college professor actually was named Olga, and she was from Colombia. So if you take a look at our chocolate chipotle cookie, the signature elephant there is Dona Olga. So she has is very much a Spanish Colombian feel to her. And is named after Olga. And then you go to M's Blues, the signature elephant for our blueberry maple cookie. And she's really quite a character. If you look at the label, she has a beehive and cat eye glasses. And one of the bakers at the time who helped me quite a bit developing that recipe, we had a lot of fun working on it together. And she... I said to her, and her name was M, her name was Megan. I said, well, Megan, if you were an elephant, what would you look like? And she said, well, I'd have cat eye glasses and a beehive. And so that was our rendition on that. But the other, one of the really cute stories, the Duchess of Rue, who is the matriarch of all of the elephants, she is really with the iced cookies, which you can see on our website, queencitycookies.com. She was named after my dear friend who is the executive director of the governor's mansion in the state of Kentucky. And it was, she got the name Duchess because Megan, the other baker that I referenced earlier, thought mistakenly, of course, that because she worked for the governor, that somehow made her a duchess. So we started calling her the Duchess in jest.
How did the Schneckens get into this act?
Schnecken
actually is a very, very popular sweet yeast bread that is, of course, filled with sugar and raisins and lots of butter. And Schnecken in German means little snail. So if you look at the top of the loaf, it has three little circular rolls that are evocative of a snail shell.
But it's certainly not little.
They're not little.
And they're essentially sticky buns, aren't they?
Well, it really depends. Sticky bun actually is cooked baked in a different methodology than these are.
I see.
Sticky buns traditionally, I believe, are not flipped over and left to caramelize outside of the pan.
Right.
I think that's the distinction, but they're very, very similar. But Schnecken are very, very popular in New York, Greenberg. I haven't been to Greenberg Bakery, but I probably a lot of your listeners have in New York City. It's very famous there, very well known in Baltimore. I've heard in Philly. It's traditionally springs from the Jewish culture.
Uh-huh.
And, in fact, I believe was brought to Cincinnati in the 20s or 1910s by influence of the Jewish culture. And then the Germans in Cincinnati really took it over and have claimed it as their own.
Well, do you have different flavors? We got them with chocolate bacon.
No, maple bacon.
Maple bacon. It's the one we got.
That was really exciting. That was won a Silver Sophie at the Fancy Food Show this year. It was nominated for Outstanding New Product of the Year, which is, of course, tantamount to winning Best Picture at the Oscars. So we didn't win. Lemon Lint Sorbet beat us out, but it's awfully delicious.
If
there had been a category called non-diet foods, you would have won a gold Sophie hands down.
I understand. Well, actually, Ann asked me what the nutritional panel.
I mean, how many calories in one of those, Peggy?
I mean, it's too scary to even think of. We used all natural Pellugra butter and lots of it. There's over 10 ounces in each pound loaf. So when we make it, it's really, really delicious because of that. So it's one of those items that, you know, you eat with discipline and or reckless abandon.
And I don't even have a sweet tooth that I say, I mean, those are really wonderful. You could just taste the quality in them of the ingredients, you know.
They're really delicious.
Now, Peter did not have that discipline. He downed two.
No, well, somebody had to taste one, so I ate one when they arrived.
You pulled the hazardous duty, huh, Peter?
Yeah, then the next day there were two left, so we had a chef, young chef from just down the street coming over to pick some herbs from the garden, and he looked thin enough. So I said, would you like a Schnecken? He said he would love a Schnecken, so I gave him the second Schnecken, and I ate the third one. And,
yes, well, I'm glad that you helped that way. I don't know if you've seen our food truck. We like to call it the Schnecken Shack,
uh-huh.
And it's a pink and periwinkle elephant.
Oh, nice. That
we sell Schnecken out of.
Well, you
have
it at the Fancy Food Show. That's the one you have at the Fancy Food Show.
Yeah, it's our booth.
Well, I'm a little worried about something, though. So you're going to have to reassure me, and you're going to have to reassure our listeners, because we had to reschedule this interview because you were too busy baking the other day, and I understand that you just filled probably way times your largest order.
Oh, ever, yeah.
With a new chain. So what I'm worried about is that we'll turn all these people on to Queen City Cookies, and then there won't be any.
No, we are actually moving. Hopefully, we'll be in the new space. It's very, very exciting for us. It's been just such a crazy ride. We started the company in April, really, of 2010, so not very long ago, and I started in my basement, and then, which is not your traditional basement, I have to say, the ceilings are 13 feet high, and it has a footprint of about 5,000 square feet.
Oh, wow.
So it's the last existing Jergens home in Cincinnati, the Jergens soap maker. So the house is just amazing, but the basement was large enough that I could have a commercial kitchen in the basement. And then after our first Christmas, actually that was 2009, the first Christmas, we have a three-story carriage house on the property, and I converted that to a commercial bakery, and now we're just bursting at the seams. And a month ago, I started construction on, it's a historic church. It was built in 1810, and we'll have a retail bakery in the church, and then behind the church is a gymnasium that's about 9,000 square feet, and that'll be the wholesale bakery. So we'll have a lot of room to produce tons of cookies and lots of Schnecken.
People order online?
They can order online at queencitycookies.com, and they're available at Fresh Market and Sur La Table, and we're in Whole Foods and Dean and DeLuca all over the United States.
I think that anybody who just wants to appreciate the most wonderful, elevating, I would say uplifting, I guess is what I want, packaging is how you wrap and send these things. You have ribbons, and you have little what do you call those little cards with the sayings on them? The sort
those
of
are so much fun. I really love the inspirational cards, and we write it, include a handwritten message in each package, and it's not just about the food, it's about the entire experience around the food.
And, you know, we have yet to mention you do an awful lot of charity.
It's really the reason to be in business for me. I mentioned, I was the marketing director at a art center in town, and I was so frustrated by the cut of funding to the arts, and in particular, you know, I just heard one too many conversations that the public swimming pools for the summer, for the second year in a row, were going to have to close because of budget cuts. And I just said, you know, the world doesn't need another bakery, but it does need a business that's committed to changing the world through whatever sales that they might generate. And so that's really what the catalyst was for starting Queen City Cookies, and certainly what gets me out of bed and goes to work 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, to make the company successful so we can really donate.
Well, it's a wonderful story, and the only thing I'm worried about now, then, since you've reassured me that there'll be cookies available, is when you're going to have your elephant farm in Cincinnati. So be sure to dial us up when that happens, or at least send us a picture.
No, that'll be a lot of fun, and believe me, I'll be looking forward to that.
And in the meantime, Peggy, once again, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to hear another success story and a great product. And listeners, as long as you can stand the calories, you better get some.
Yeah. Thanks, Peggy.
Thank you, Ann, and thank you, Peter. Thanks so much. We really enjoyed it.
We enjoyed sharing this hour with you. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.